Hey there, everyone, and thanks for checking out episode 3 of the Eyes Free Sports podcast. Once again, this is Greg Lindberg here with you. This is part 1 of a 2-part conversation we had with Kyle Kuhn, who is a very accomplished blind athlete who has achieved many things already and has many goals ahead of him as well. So let's dive into part 1 here with Kyle Kuhn. All right, so joining me now on the podcast is Kyle Kuhn. Kyle, welcome aboard.
Hey, Greg. Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on Ice Free Sports.
Definitely appreciate you coming on. This is going to be a lot of fun. So I have several questions for you just about, kind of things that you've achieved and, you know, growing up, going to college, just kind of your life story. So let's kind of go chronologically here. Talk to me about where were you born and where did you grow up?
So I was actually born in Chicago, Illinois, but didn't live there long enough to call it home. So I actually grew up in Jacksonville, Florida. I was mainstreamed in school all throughout growing up, you know, all the way from elementary all the way up through high school. And then once I graduated from high school, went to college at the University of Central Florida, there in Orlando, born in Chicago, raised in Florida, and then eventually made my way out here to Colorado after graduating from college.
And then, so I was reading it was a form of eye cancer that you had as a baby.
So I actually was diagnosed with a rare form of eye cancer called bilateral sporadic retinoblastoma when I was 10 months old. And I went through several years of various cancer treatments. So I did a lot of chemotherapy, radiation therapy. I sometimes joke around that the doctors took the medical textbooks, threw them at me. And when all the known stuff didn't work, then they just started kind of making it up as they went along. But overall, I was gifted with several years of, I considered, decent sight. I mean, it was what I knew, but I was diagnosed at the University of Chicago. And then when my family moved down to Florida, I spent a lot of time traveling back and forth from my doctors in Jacksonville up to some retinoblastoma specialists in Philadelphia. So one of my parents and I would travel every few weeks or once a month or so to go up to Philadelphia for some specialty treatment. And then we also did a lot of treatment there in Jacksonville as well. But ultimately, what happened was I would respond very well to the cancer treatment. The tumors would shrink and, you know, it looked like we would be in the clear. But then they would come back just a little bit stronger than before. And then we'd go at it again and they'd shrink and then come back stronger. So eventually, the toll of the treatment on both of my eyes just took such a heavy toll on the structure of my eyes that we had no choice but to remove my eyes. So we removed my left eye when I was 5 years old and then had to remove my right eye just before I turned 7.
And thinking back, what would you say, like, can you kind of describe maybe the best vision that you had?
It's hard to think back that far as to what, like, the best vision that I had was. Like, I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly what my visual acuity or anything like that was. I mean, I was visually impaired basically from the time that I can remember. But I mean, I could see well enough to play basketball, to rollerblade, to run around with my friends, ride my bike, and do stuff like that. But from what I remember, like, my peripheral vision wasn't great. Things were probably a little blurry, but I mean, I didn't know what crystal clear 20/20 vision was.
So, yeah.
I mean, it's all I basically knew until I had no sight at all.
And then talk about, you know, how did you feel? I know you mentioned having, you know, both eyes removed, and when you kind of, you know, were at the point of no vision at all, how did that make you feel?
I knew that I was going to go totally blind. I mean, my parents and my doctors had prepared me as best they could. And I kind of went half blind.
Right. And, yeah, correct.
When, when I had my left eye removed. So that really affected my field of vision. I was only seeing half of the world at that point. And then, you know, when I woke up in the hospital after having my right eye removed, I was scared. I was angry, upset. As a kid, you don't think, how am I going to get a job, have a family, do things on my own? You know, just right then and there, as a 6-7 year old kid, you're thinking, how the heck am I going to go out and play basketball, rollerblade, ride my bike, play with my friends? You know, do that kind of stuff. It was hard, and you know, I was definitely sad and devastated. You know, I spent a lot of time immediately afterwards just kind of sitting in my room, you know, maybe listening to books on tape or listening to television or something along those lines. Spent a lot of time just listening to my friends playing outside in the neighborhood, like, you know, playing basketball, rollerblading, and doing all the stuff that I used to do with them. And I was just, you know, sad and angry that I couldn't go out there and participate with them like I used to.
So then talk about, you know, how you kind of got that motivation to be active again. I know you talked about, you know, before losing both eyes, you were pretty active and played a lot of sports and whatnot. And what inspired you to kind of, you know, get back into that?
So I was actually really, really lucky. So a couple of months after I lost my right eye, my dad was actually connected with a gentleman named Ed Weinmayer. So Ed lived in this, basically the next town over from Jacksonville. And he came to my dad's Rotary Club to talk about his totally blind son, Eric Weinmayer. And Dad was able to talk with Ed and, you know, basically told him about me. And so Ed arranged for Eric to come into town and do some speaking engagements and stuff. And in conjunction with that, arranged for Eric to meet me. So I sat down with this, you know, adult blind guy, and he basically told me all about the crazy things that he did. He was a downhill skier. He was a rock climber. He was a mountaineer. He was a skydiver. He, you know, did tandem cycling. He was a runner, just did all this crazy stuff. And a few years later, after I met him for the first time, he became known worldwide as becoming the first totally blind person to climb at summit Mount Everest. I met Eric, you know, probably 2 or 3 years before he climbed Everest, and we just got to talking, and he told me about all the really cool stuff that he did, and he just basically challenged me to be creative with how I do things. Just because I no longer could see didn't mean I couldn't still be active and do the things I love to do. I just needed to be a little bit more creative. And so he told me to go and try rock climbing. And so I was connected with some family friends were members of a rock climbing gym in town. And so they took me and we worked out a system where they would talk me up the rock wall. And, you know, I started climbing when I was probably 7 or 8 years old and fell in love with that sport. Turned out to be decently okay at it enough to where, you know, my whole family actually, it became a whole family activity and sport. My sisters got into it as well. And a couple years into it, us just kind of having fun with it, my sisters and I, my parents put us on the competitive rock climbing team, and we traveled all over and rock climbed competitively against kids our own age. You know, and to the best of my knowledge, I was one of the first totally blind competitive rock climbers in the U.S. and the world.
Oh, wow.
that was doing it on a regular full-time basis. And I was only 10, 11, 12 years old at the time when I was competing. And it was before rock climbing was a sport that a lot of people thought a blind person could do. So Eric had done it and had shown that you could do it as a blind person, but it was a lot of fun trying to do this at a competitive level. And that was a ton of fun traveling with my sisters and my teammates and going to to different gyms and competing against kids my own age and being the only blind kid doing it. So it was pretty rad. And then, you know, rock climbing kind of bled over into hiking and backpacking and camping. A lot of, you know, that just kind of bled over into more and more outdoor adventure type stuff. My parents, instead of giving my sisters and I Christmas presents every year, decided to take us on a ski trip every year, probably starting when I was about 11 or 12 years old. And so I got introduced to downhill skiing. And so started recreationally downhill skiing a bunch. My dad and I started tandem cycling together probably when I was about 9 or 10 years old as well. Getting involved in all these sporting activities and stuff allowed me to kind of fit back in with my friends. And a lot of my friends got into the stuff that I was doing as well. And eventually, you know, my parents trusted my friends enough to let them pilot my tandem bike, or we would go on like little camping trips with Boy Scouts and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, athletics and, you know, that outdoor adventure lifestyle kind of helped me get back on my feet in the social realm, as well as just being an active person.
Very cool. And then I know that you have climbed several mountains and did so like as a teenager, you know, even several years back. Can you talk about some of those experiences and just what, you know, for a blind person, how they actually do that?
For sure. So when I was 14, it was 2006, I was accepted into a program called Leading the Way, and it was run by an organization. At the time, it was called Global Explorers. Now it's known as No Barriers. It was a trip that Eric Weinmayer had put together, and it was partnering blind and sighted teenagers from across the U.S. to do an epic hiking trip, as well as perform some community service projects and stuff along those lines. So that first trip that we did with the Leading the Way program was to, we hiked the Ancascocha Trail, which is a variation of the Inca Trail. So it's a trail that takes about twice as long and climbs over a few higher mountain passes than the standard Inca Trail. So we basically hiked from Cusco to Machu Picchu. It took us about 6 or 7 days. And along the way, we stopped in a small community in the mountains and painted a school and spent a whole day with the students and the parents and the teachers of that school, and just had a blast doing that. And eventually we made it to Machu Picchu and did a tour of Machu Picchu. And then on the train ride from Machu Picchu back to Cusco, at the end of our trip, a few of us kind of hashed out this plan that, hey, we had loved hiking together and hanging out together and just, you know, being around each other so much that we wanted to do another similar trip the following year. And so a few of us got together and said, hey, let's do something a little bigger, a little harder, but somewhere different in the world. So let's try climbing Mount Kilimanjaro, which is the tallest mountain in Africa. So No Barriers came on board and wound up organizing the trip for us. And it was essentially the second Leading the Way expedition that they had put together. And it was comprised primarily of all the people from the first Leading the Way program that they'd done. And so I was in 2007, I was 15, and I went with several of my friends that I had made from the previous summer's trip to Peru. There were 4 of us that were either totally blind or visually impaired. And then there were 6 sighted students. And then we also had 2 sighted adults who were our guides and
chaperones,
guardians,
yeah.
Essentially.
Right. Yep.
For the trip. But yeah, no, as a 15-year-old, I went and climbed and summited Mount Kilimanjaro. And that was just a really awesome experience to to stand on top of a continent and a mountain that you hear so much about. It's not just the tallest mountain in Africa. It's the tallest freestanding mountain in the world, meaning that it's not part of a mountain range. And then, you know, you're also standing on top of a dormant volcano, which is pretty cool. It was an awesome experience. And then that climb kind of again bled over into doing some more climbing and adventuring with friends and teammates. So in 2008 I climbed Mount St. Helens. In 2010 we made an attempt on Gannett Peak, which is the tallest mountain in Wyoming, and unfortunately I had to turn around a couple thousand feet below the summit. Just because I had some really, really bad blisters, and it was getting late in the day, and it was unsafe to continue climbing, and we still had a 26 mile hike to get out, and we needed to get out in just a couple of days because we had planes to catch back home. That trip bled over into me spending a lot of time in Colorado climbing some Colorado 14ers and just, you know, basically just becoming an outdoor junkie and enthusiast.
And then just briefly going back to, say, mountain climbing, rock climbing, what kind of adaptations or techniques or things did you use as a, you know, as a blind person to do those?
Yeah, so as a rock climber, what we did, what I did and what I still use today, because I still rock climb, recreationally, just for fun. I use my body as the hands of a clock in the wall as a clock face, and I have someone standing on the ground yelling up to me where climbing holds are based on the position of a clock. So they can say, like, right hand out to 1 o'clock, or left hand out to 11 o'clock, right foot up to 3 o'clock, left foot out to 8:30. Or something along those lines. And so when I've climbed outside and we're doing big, you know, sandstone or granite towers where you can be 100, 150, 200 feet up above your climbing partner, and they're having to scream really loudly, I've used a two-way radio where I hook a radio onto my climbing harness, and then I run an earpiece up under my shirt and up to my ear so that they can just talk normally. Right. And it goes right into my ear. I've used that before. And then for hiking and mountaineering and those types of activities, what I like to do is I use two trekking poles. So they're a little bit sturdier than your standard white cane. I use a couple of trekking poles that are made of carbon fiber, and they provide a little bit more stability for me. And then I usually have someone hike in front of me with like a bear bell, and I can hear the sound of the bell jingling. And then my guide, who's, you know, hiking in front of me, you know, can tell me step up onto a rock, step over a root, coming up to a stream crossing. They can also kind of, you know, if we're having to rock hop across a wide stream or a river or something, they can, you know, take my pole and place it on the precise place where they want me to step. And then I can also use my trekking poles to scan the ground in front of me, just to make sure that I don't miss any obstacles that they may have missed in calling out. That's the method that I use. There are plenty of methods that other people use. I know a lot of people that will hike with just one trekking pole in one hand, and they'll put a hand, their other hand on their guide's backpack. Or I have a buddy who lives in New Hampshire who hikes with his who hikes and climbs with his guide dog, and his dog walks on his left side, and he holds the harness handle, and then he uses a trekking pole in his right hand for extra balance and stability, and also to scan the ground to see if there's any other obstacles in the way that the dog might not pick up on. So, so there's all kinds of different ways that you can hike or climb or just be active doing that kind of adventure stuff. You just gotta be creative and find out what works for you.
Yeah, that's awesome. Just you know, some fairly simple techniques, like you were saying, that can make a world of difference. Let's talk about running. I know you got into running, I guess, maybe as a teenager. I'm not sure exactly what age, but how did you get into running? And then again, talk about the adaptations and what's involved in that.
So in high school and college, I was actually a wrestler. So I wrestled for all 4 years in high school, and then I wrestled for a year and a half in college at the University of Central Florida. And eventually, you know, just some injuries caught up with me. I fell out of love with the sport of wrestling, just as a doing the daily grind of it. And eventually, you know, I had to graduate from college. But after I stopped wrestling, I became a group exercise instructor, teaching at the University of Central Florida. So I was teaching a lot of spin classes. I taught a lot of washboard abs classes, some basic strength classes, some flexibility stuff. I did a lot of that. And I also became a personal trainer as well. So I was staying fairly active until I graduated from UCF. And then when I graduated, I was no longer a student employee, and had to go out and find my own way and figure out how to make a living.
Yep.
You know, go look for that, you know, that job thing that, you know, we all, you know, love and hate.
Right.
and so I actually really struggled finding employment. I sent out hundreds upon hundreds of job applications, and I think I got somewhere in the realm of 30 or 35 or 40 in-person or phone interviews, and never got a job offer. With every non-call back, or, you know, we've decided to go in a different direction or something along those lines, I got, you know, just more and more depressed. I wasn't as active during that time in my life as I would have liked. I was stress eating a lot. I was drinking a lot of alcohol at the time, and was just getting more and more depressed and getting a more and more negative view of the world. Cause, you know, I'd grown up as the classic millennial, and, you know, people, you know, telling me, oh, you can do anything you want. If you, you could be anything you want to be and do anything you want to do. And then I get into this workforce, and, I go in with the classic millennial mindset of, you know, I have all the experience I need. I don't need to start from the bottom and work my way to the top. I was that millennial that said, I'm going to apply for every job CEO and above. And then that didn't work. I started working my way down the corporate ladder. And the breaking point actually, you know, came when I went into a grocery store and applied for a bag boy job and did not get a job bagging groceries. So, here I was college educated. I graduated from the University of Central Florida after just 3 years of study, because I graduated early. And, you know, I had also been this elite, you know, rock climber. I'd done a lot of, you know, mountaineering and stuff like that. And I couldn't even get a grocery bagger job. And the one thing that had always kind of kept me grounded and brought me joy and happiness was activity. So I was like, well, I got nothing else better to do, so I think I want to try running. But to run, I either needed to run on a treadmill, or I needed to run with a guide. And so I jumped on a website that partnered blind and sighted runners, partnered blind runners or people that wanted to be runners or triathletes or just active. It partnered them with sighted guides based on your zip code. And so I was still living in Orlando at the time. And so I plugged in my zip code, and two people popped up in the entire Orlando area that had signed up for this website. And I emailed both of them, and one of those guys responded. And at that point I was just like, well, you know, beggars can't be choosers. So
yeah,
I went and I met up with him, and he had never actually met a blind person. He had never guided a blind person running. He had just kind of signed up for the website on a whim. And I was like, well, I've not really done a whole lot of running in my life, but let's figure this out. So we went on a short little run together the first time, and I think within the first 10 minutes of us running together, he ran me smack into a pole. And but we picked ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and just kind of forged ahead and kept working out our systems. And eventually we started running a couple times a week together. He was a triathlete and was training for the Ironman Kona, which takes place in Kona, Hawaii, and which is the world championship of Ironman triathlon. And that race was, I think, 2 or 3 months away when we first met. And he went off and raced in Kona, did very well. He came back from Hawaii and we continued running together, and he just kept kind of pestering me. He was like, you know, Kyle, I think you can do, I think you can race triathlon at some point in your life. You're tough and you know, you're kind of getting the hang of this running thing. So I actually went ahead and signed you up for a marathon. And I was like, oh, well, great. So well, we got a year to train or something, Mike. And he's like, oh, no. I signed you up for the Disney Marathon. So that's only like 2 months away.
Wow.
Okay. Thanks, buddy. and then he drops the bombshell on me. He's like, oh, but the actual marathon itself was actually sold out. So I had to sign us up for the Goofy Challenge. So don't worry though. All you have to do is run a half marathon the day before, and then you run the marathon the next day. And at this point I had never run further than I think 8 or 10 miles in my life at a time.
Yeah.
So I had had a little bit of a crash course and cram session for my first marathon, and you know, which came after running a half marathon the day before. But absolutely loved it. Loved grinding it out and suffering and having to figure out how to eat and drink and all that and stay fueled and hydrated during 2 days of just nonstop running. And after I finished the Goofy Challenge, my buddy Mike was like, if you can do the Goofy Challenge as your first marathon, then we need to get you doing triathlon because you just got the mindset for it. And so he took me to one of the local pools, threw me in and said, start swimming. And and that's kind of how, and that was kind of my introduction to triathlon. And you know, the first few times that I got in the pool and started to swim, I couldn't make it the length of the pool without stopping to catch my breath. But you know, Mike was an extremely patient teacher and coach, and worked with me on developing my swim technique. And I had ridden bikes my whole life. I had ridden tandem bikes especially for a long time, so we were able to get my tandem bike in ship shape because I hadn't ridden it in a few years. So I started swimming a couple times a week, and then Mike and I started biking a couple of times a week, and then we were still running a few times a week. And I think it was, you know, two, three months after doing the Goofy Challenge, I did my first triathlon in St. Petersburg, Florida, called St. Anthony's. It was an Olympic distance race, so it was a 1,500-meter swim in Tampa Bay, then it was a 40-kilometer bike ride, and then followed by a 10-kilometer run. took me 3.5 hours to do the entire thing. But again, just so exhilarated and so fired up and pumped up about it when I crossed the finish line, and I just kept getting sucked into this endurance athlete culture and mindset, and I love pushing myself and seeing if I could get faster at swimming, cycling, and running. And so I continued to test myself at various triathlons, and eventually built my way up to doing a half Ironman, which is a 1.2 mile swim, a 56 mile bike ride, and a 13.1 mile run. And then eventually made my way to completing a full distance Ironman, which is a 2.4 mile swim, 112 mile bike, and 26.2 mile run. And so I did my first Ironman in Boulder, Colorado in 2016. And that race took me just under 16 hours to complete. So you're out there basically the entire day. You start racing before the sun comes up, and you're racing after the sun goes down. And I think I finished just before 11 p.m. at night. It was a raucous crowd. That was, it was a party atmosphere. And when you cross the finish line of your first Ironman, it was so surreal. Just thinking like, wow, I traveled 140.6 miles powered by nothing but my body. You had to, swimming 2.4 miles, and then you cycling 112 miles, and then running 26.2 miles. And, that was just it was an addictive feeling. And so I decided that I had to do another Ironman. And so I actually wound up doing two more Ironmans. I did Ironman Arizona in 2017 and knocked over 4 hours off of my time from Ironman Boulder in 2016. So I wound up going 11 hours and 46 minutes at Ironman Arizona in 2017. And then I learned that was actually I had become only the eighth person that was blind or visually impaired, or eighth or ninth person that was blind or visually impaired to go under 12 hours for an Ironman distance. And I was like, oh, well, my competitive side kicked in. So, well, if 11:46 is, only the eighth fastest blind Ironman of all time, I mean, I could probably go a little bit faster. So in 2018, I actually went back to Ironman Arizona and was able to become the first person who was totally blind to break 11 hours for an Ironman. So again, that 2.4 mile swim, 112 mile bike, and 26.2 mile run I completed in 10 hours and 59 minutes. That was quite the experience. So I never was really a runner, a cyclist, or a swimmer. I just kind of built all three together, and it was it just became this thing. And I became a triathlete through and through, and it was a sport that I fell in love with, and it was a sport that I wanted to dedicate a large part of my time to.
Yeah, that's just so fascinating. And I know, like you were saying before, it sounds like you were literally thrown into the fire, especially when it comes to swimming and running. And it sounds like you really had no expectation of ever, competing at this level.
I never anticipated, when I, like I said, I graduated from UCF in 2013. And then in 2014 was when I took up running. So it was almost, it was just over a year from when I had graduated to when I started running. And then I picked up cycling and swimming, and just kind of morphed into triathlon. When I started running and triathlon, it wasn't to be competitive. It was just to get moving. It was really more of a distraction than anything. It was more of a distraction from being unemployed. It was a distraction from, I was in a relationship at the time that was, that was in the beginning stages of falling apart. So it was a distraction from the troubles that I was having in my relationship. But triathlon and endurance sports brought me this whole new set of friends. It brought me into a community that really embraces anyone and everyone, whether you have a disability or not. And it was a pretty amazing thing to get sucked into. And I started out fairly slow as a runner. I mean, my first marathon I did in 5 hours and 49 minutes. But, you know, eventually I worked my way down to where I was able to qualify for the Boston Marathon. I've actually been able to run the Boston Marathon twice since then. And,
wow.
And then also, you know, and then again, just, you know, and like I said, you know, my first Ironman took me nearly 16 hours and, within a couple of years of just chipping away and working at it and, working hard and being patient and being creative with, you know, finding, training guides and training partners and people to race with, I was able to work my way down to, you know, being one of the fastest totally blind Ironman athletes of all time. And then that eventually led to being recruited to compete at the international level and to chase representing the U.S. at the Paralympics. So it's been quite the journey over the last, you know, 5-6 years since I took up the endurance sport lifestyle.
Yeah, just amazing.
We continue our conversation with Kyle in part 2, which you can hear in episode 4 of the Eyes Free Sports podcast. Be sure to follow the Eyes Free Sports podcast at facebook.com/eyesfreesports and on Twitter @eyesfreesports.